details about NMR that you will hear about in this conference, I guess. So I'm coming from Université Paris Sud, Paris, and this is a picture from my group. And okay, heavy snow in December, not last December, but the year before. And so we are typically working on frustrated magnetism and spin liquids, and these are the people working here. Jeff Quilliam will be at this conference. Edwin is in the audience. This was a former postdoc, he's now in Grenoble, and Fabrice Baer will be here as well, giving a talk. And the other part of the group is works on metals, correlated electrons, superconductivity, spin chains. And here is the founder of the group, Henri Alloux, who is emeritus, and you have many other members here, and students and postdocs. Okay, so let's step back a little bit, and NMR is a resonant technique, and it's one in the world of resonance techniques, such as Mossbauer, NuSR, ESR. And at variance with a previous technique, all these probes are local probes, which means that if you take locality as a direct point in space, then if you go to the reciprocal space, it's going to integrate over Q. So you have to have that in mind. We have not a Q-resolved, except in some cases, a Q-resolved probe. So there is a similar formalism for all these techniques. And they are different through the coupling to the environment, the time window, the field range you can access, and the sensitivity, and also the kind of technique, pulse versus continuum, which I won't enter into the details. So if you want to really to trace back to history, you go back to Zeeman and Rebbe, and these techniques are resonant because what you are going to do is have resonance between two levels, two magnetic levels, which degeneracy is split by the application of the field. So this is the main principle that you have to remember. So you apply a field, or there does exist a field in your sample, more or less. And what you are interested in is not the external field, of course, but is additional local field, which tracks the susceptibility and the fluctuations inside your sample. So so this is for the static part. And for the dynamical part, you are going to change the population of these levels by applying your resonant technique. And then you are going to track as well how the system returns to equilibrium. This is called relaxation. And at variance again with neutrons, what we probe here is very low frequency fluctuations. You could say omega equals zero, nearly equals to zero. So this is the difference between let's say NMR and neutron scattering. So I cited ESR. So ESR is much more involved, and if you look at the papers about ESR, and the reason why is that it's not compared to NMR, Mossbauer, and USR weak. You have a weak perturbation of your system when you play with it. ESR, you are playing with the spins themselves, and you cannot treat them in perturbation. So you have quite complicated approach with involved Hamiltonians. So what we do usually, and I'm not going to enter into the details of the techniques, you have a resonant technique, so you can sweep the frequency and try at a fixed external field and try to find the resonance. And sometimes you will see some spectra which x-axis is resonance frequency. Or you can fix your frequency and sweep the field until you find the resonance. And this is, in most cases, what we do with frustrated magnets, because the lines are very broad, and so we need to sweep over very large fields, otherwise you have to span frequencies, which is not very, very easy. And sometimes, I said we need some fields, there are some internal fields, so you don't need to apply a field, or even, I'll show you what that is, nuclear quadrupole resonance, you can also track some properties. So basically, the presentation is the following. I will treat first the basics, energy levels, coupling Hamiltonian quadrupolar effects. So you will see a little bit too many Hamiltonians maybe. I apologize for this, but I try to take out the main information. And then I split my presentation into two parts, tracking the static local properties, so what we call the shift. I will show you that it's a site-resolved technique to track the susceptibility. We can also track some magnetic ordering, structural effects, and spin textures which are induced by defects. So I tried to select a few examples. Well, that's what I have found. And I will then talk about dynamical studies and mainly focus on T1 relaxation. And if I have time, I will just sketch a comparison with the USR technique, which is very similar. So to finish with a background, NMR is a very widespread technique. Just this slide is to show you that it has many applications in chemistry, and maybe the chemists in the audience know NMR by characterization tool in chemistry, or even in medicine, and this is the most famous outreach of NMR with MRI, actually. You use NMR for making medical exams. So the field in MRI is horizontal. We do prefer having a vertical geometry. This is a magnet for a chemist. And the reason why we don't need sophisticated magnets is just because we have very broad lines, so we don't need a very high resolution. So the typical fields are 7 teslas, 23 teslas. This is quite one of the highest fields for chemistry. This is our cryo-free magnet, no helium liquid, 14 teslas that we can sweep with a dilution fridge inside. And you can even go to, so this is a larger scale facility, and NMR in high magnetic fields. This is a hybrid magnet from Grenoble, and Talas C, 45 tesla. So here, these are the cooling pipes for the magnet. You have to take the water from the river, which is nearby. So that gives you the scale of this experiment. OK, so let's go to the basics. So what you have a nuclear spin in a magnetic field, right? And so you just look at the Hamiltonian, which is very simple. You have energy levels, which are given by these quantum numbers. And all these energy levels are equidistant. And the energy difference is precisely h times nu, and nu is your resonance frequency. So you have a single resonance frequency, and what you want to do is to induce transition, C resonance, between these levels. So for this, if you go back to basic quantum mechanics, you need to apply a radio frequency field, radio frequency because it this energy corresponds to radio frequencies of the order of a few 10 megahertz, let's say. You need to apply a field perpendicular to the field you have applied to make this splitting. So the geometry is that you have a radio frequency and you excite your resonances. And finally, at the end of your pulses, not at the end of the day because it's quite easy, you get a resonance line. So said as this, this is not a very interesting experiment because what you are measuring is the external field, right? So you have a very accurate magnetometers based on NMR, but what we are interested in is the additional fields which comes from your local environment. And what we are interested in is a measurement of this, what we call the shift here. And it directly relates to the distribution of local fields. So we measure the average, this is the shift, and the distribution. And if you know that, you know everything, more or less, about NMR. OK. So a priori, you cannot do NMR without a field. So if you have an internal field, like in an antiferromagnet, you can do some NMR in some cases. And there is also one case with NQR, where you don't need to apply. OK, there are many nuclei, which are quite good. So these are the most common NMR active nuclei. Oxygen is very useful because we have many oxides, but you need to enrich your samples with oxygen-17. Fluorine is a very good nucleus. Proton is a very good nucleus. You will hear about them during this conference, especially in organic materials. Deuterium as well. And we have a full palette of nuclei which we can use, like more exotic from the chemistry point of view, copper, gallium, and so on and so on. OK, so we have many nuclei which are in our samples. And then the only problem is the sensitivity, the detection problems, but this is the business of the NMR experimentalist. Okay, you have to spend some time about this. So the experimental setups, so the field range we can play with is typically from 1 Tesla to 45 Tesla. Temperature range is easily accessible, more or less. 10 mK is more involved than 300K, of course, and you can even go to 1,000K. The sensitivity, we cannot work on thin layers. The sensitivity is typically one millimole. Well, of course, it depends on the nucleus you are using or something like that. And we can also do pressure experiments, rotate single crystals in situ and so on. So this is typically what we can do with NMR. So let's see the Hamiltonian. It's quite a complicated Hamiltonian. You have this Z-man. Then you have a dipole-dipole interaction between the nuclei. And then what we'll be interested in is more or less, I went too fast, nuclear-nuclear interactions, which is very small, and which is going to give you some shifts, which are known as chemical shifts, which are very tiny, 7 parts per million. You will see that our shifts are much larger, of the order of 1%. So it's used by chemists, but when you don't have a magnetic sample, actually. So you can, like this, distinguish between various chemical bondings that you have in your sample. Okay, then what we are most interested in is the interaction between nuclei and electrons, and which summarizes to some tensor relation between the nuclear moment and the electronic moment. So that's how we probe magnetism inside our sample. And then there is another part which comes out when you have an electric field gradient on your nucleus, so when you don't have a very high symmetry, and which couples this electric field gradient, couples the quadrupole moment of your nucleus to the local charge environment. And this gives you energy levels, so possibility of resonances. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about this Hamiltonian. Well, you can sleep a little bit if you want. Orbital effect. So you can couple, you interact with your surroundings. So there are orbital moments, electronic moments. So orbital effect, you have an electron which is rotating, and it's giving a field on your nucleus, which is here. So this is one source of field. Another source is a dipolar effect from an unpaired spin. Okay, so you have a dipolar coupling. And then it depends whether you are in an S state or not, because what the nucleus feels is what is on where it sits, right? So you need to see some magnetic field there. And if you have an S orbital, then the probability of presence of your electron on the nuclear site is non-zero. And then you get a very huge coupling here. And so you can start again with a P orbital, and you have an orbital effect, dipolar. And then the last one, don't have any coupling with a kind of P electron or D electron. Okay. So you have anisotropy of the couplings. The two first are anisotropic, and the last one is isotropic here. And so you have various terms in your resonance frequency. You have the external field, the orbital field, the dipolar field, and the contact field when your electron comes. And your shift, so the shift of your line, which I spoke about, is has various contributions, orbital, dipolar, contact. And there is a last one, which is called the copolarization, because when you have your electron which is sitting in some d orbital, these d orbitals can polarize as well the s electrons which are inside the shell, and they couple to the nucleus. So okay, this is our business, more or less. And you don't need to know all this, right? You just very often in the papers, I cite this because in the papers, CNMR people like to show that they have good tools and they know what they are doing. So how the nucleus is coupled to its environment. And of course, this is quite important for us to know and to show that we understand what we see. We don't make any mistake. But then, most important for us is the second part, the static local studies here. So the orbital shift usually is temperature independent. And what we care about is susceptibility in these magnetic materials, and which is temperature dependent. So this usually is, goes into a reference. We know how to determine it. And what's the main thing is tracking the spin shift, well, the susceptibility, the local susceptibility. So if you apply a field to a paramagnet, then you are going to orient all the electronic spins, more or less. Well, yeah, you don't saturate, of course. It's just a small polarization. So that the magnetization is chi times the susceptibility, and the local field is going to be schematically the external field plus the local field induced by these moments, right? And the Hamiltonian coupling is of this form, as I told you, I dot S, and what you measure with the shift of your resonance is typically the susceptibility, the electronic susceptibility. So that's fairly interesting, because this is something which you can resolve atomically speaking. So you have a nucleus, it feels the susceptibility of the nearby spins. And if you have something inhomogeneous, then you will make a histogram of these susceptibilities, whereas if you make a magnetization measurement, you are summing all the susceptibilities. So this is a big difference. We make a histogram of this susceptibility. Okay, so this spin shift is temperature dependent. It can be anisotropic because the susceptibility can be anisotropic, but also the tensor, the coupling tensor, can be anisotropic. So that we know how to study. Sometimes we don't have enough information, but with ideally a single crystal, this is something that we can determine perfectly. So we measure the local susceptibility, all this I said, and it can be also site-selected. So if you want to remember one thing, is this, right? So your line is shifting, is going to shift on the average, like the average susceptibility, okay? And the line weights is going to reflect in these magnetic materials the distribution of susceptibilities, okay? So you can detect spin defects, spin freezing, when you have a huge burning of your line, and things like that. And actually, I have written this very schematically as if we were coupled to one nearby spin, but you have to sum over all the spins you are coupled to. Okay. So let me show you one example that so all my slides are a little bit cut. Edwin Kamarek will present that in his talk on Thursday. So this is a Capella site, which is a Kagome lattice. And okay, I don't care about the physics today. And you have chlorine, so we use chlorine NMR here. And you have these coppers which are on the Kagome lattice, right? So you can say one chlorine is going to be coupled to three copper sites. So given the structure, you would expect a single chlorine line. And if you look here, you see that you have one, two, three, four lines. What does it tell you? That tells you that you have four inequivalent sites, four type of inequivalent site. And actually, what happens is that chlorine is coupled to three coppers, but you have defects. Zinc, you have substitutions of zinc to copper. So it can be coupled to two coppers and one zinc. Zinc is it's non-magnetic. And two zinc, one copper, and three zinc. And actually, with these numbers, you just measure the intensities, you integrate the intensities. And with these numbers, you can trace back the real formula of this compound, where you have zinc exchange with copper. And actually, we can even look very nicely to the shift. And if you are probing three sites, then you will get three times the susceptibility of these coppers. Two sites, twice, and you see that the ratios here, this is a shift represented versus macroscopic susceptibility, and you can see that the ratio of these slopes here is precisely 3 to 2, 1.5. So really we can map out what is the real local structure of our samples. So now the last term is the electric field gradient. So if you have a nucleus which is non-spherical, if you have a nucleus which is spherical, the charge is has a spherical symmetry, then you won't couple to the surrounding charge. Now if you have a quadrupolar moment, then you have an energy layer. The energy levels is going to be different depending whether this cigar here is like this or it's going like this, right? And the orientation of the spin is in this direction, for instance. So for spins which have a value which is above 1/2, you have these quadrupolar couplings, this electric field gradient Hamiltonian, and it has two numbers which are important. The quadrupolar frequency, which corresponds to the electric field gradient, and the asymmetry of the electric field gradient. So where does it come from? If you expand the energy, the electrostatic energy, you know that you have a dipolar term and then a quadrupolar term. And this is this quadrupolar term that we have here. So the magic of quantum mechanics is that this transforms with the Wigner-Eckhart theorem to Hamiltonian involving here these operators. Okay, so finally, if you have a quadrupolar interaction, you had these, I take a spin as 3/2, you had equidistant levels, and now you are going to have a small perturbation, if you treat that in perturbation, and when you can do that, and you are going to lift the degeneracy of these resonances. So instead of one single line, you are going to get three lines, 1, 2, 3, which are here. And the splitting of these lines is going to depend on the angle between the applied field and the principal axis of it, of your electric field gradient. So that if you take, so this is a formula, you don't care too much, but if you take a powder, you are going to average over theta and have a line shape which is of this type with singularities and cutoffs. So that we know, we know how to trace that sort it out. If you don't apply any field, then all your levels which were all the same, then if you have a quadrupolar Hamiltonian, an electric field gradient and a spin which is above 1/2, then you are going to split your levels. There was an m square in the formula here, so you have two levels for a spin 3/2. So without applying any field, you have a quadrupolar nuclear resonance, NQR, nuclear quadrupolar resonance. And you have one line here, which is related to the surrounding charges of the nucleus. So you can also have some information about the structure using NQR. And this is one example. It was already shown in the previous talk, in the previous presentation, nickel gallium sulfide. And again, gallium, if the structure would be perfect, then you would get one gallium size, right? So gallium has two isotopes, and actually what you see is a pair of nuclear resonances here, which is just NQR, you don't apply any field. And you also see a second pair here, which tells you that you have some defects in your structure. So it's a very refined tool to detect structural details in the sample. Okay, of course, now that you have all this, if you look at the paper, the spectra look a little bit cumbersome. Why? Because you have to average over the angle if you have a powder, if you don't have the luck to have a single crystal. And you have a hyperfine tensor, which is can be non-diagonal. And you have also the electric field gradients, depending on which nucleus you are looking at. And the axis of all of these two tensors are not necessarily the same. You have to look at the local structure. So at the end of the day, it's quite complicated spectrum, and you have to fit them, and that we have all the tools needed for that. So let me give you some examples. This is a very complicated spectrum. This is this kind of spectrum. This is a powder. This is Herbert-Smith Act, which you have heard about. And this is the oxygen, and the oxygen is bridging two coppers which are in the Kagome plates. So it's a very interesting because this is the way, it's a very strong coupling, and this is the way the coppers are coupled by exchange interaction. So if you look at this, this is just a shift experiment. You vary the temperature and you see, you look at this line, it's just a zoom, and you see that it's shifting, right? It's shifting. And it's shifting more and more. That tells you you have a reference here. Zero would be around here. So this tells you that the susceptibility increases in this temperature range. So the spectrum is quite complicated, but if you find the right line, then you can follow the susceptibility. And you can map out the susceptibility. The first talk was about how is the susceptibility looking like in Herbert-Smith site. You heard about that. Is it a spin liquid? Has it a gap? Isn't it gap? So the macroscopic susceptibility has an upturn because of defects. You have some coppers which go on this zinc site, which is not in the Kagome planes. And these coppers are really just like free spins. So they give you this huge Curie tail. And even in single crystals, they are beautiful single crystals, but you have this exchange. So the macroscopic susceptibility will never tell you what is going on in the Kagome planes. We are lucky that these copper defects, which are here, you know, they don't contribute to the physics because they are very weakly coupled. So the only problem is we measure with macroscopic tools, but we don't know what exactly we measure because we have this huge Curie tail. With the oxygen 17, the oxygen is just coupled preferentially to these coppers. We can measure the local susceptibility here. And you see that you have a downturn. And then you will see in the talks this week, that's already an old result. The susceptibility doesn't drop to zero. So I would say it's a spin liquid without a gap because you still have some susceptibility. Okay. Now you can take the same sample. I'm just willing to illustrate the site selective aspect. So if you take deuterium, and that has been done on a single crystal. So what is telling you, what does this spectrum tell you? Deuterium is here, and you have this oxygen here. And actually, the deuterium is not very well coupled to the Kagome planes. And what you see here, deuterium is a spin 1. So you expect two lines when you do so. And you see that you have one set of lines, a second set of lines, and a third set of lines, which is the C lines. A, B, C. Well, actually, you see five lines, but there are ones which are together. So that tells you what? That tells you that the local environment of deuterium is not the same everywhere. You would expect that if you would have a perfect Kagome. And the reason why, it's again because you have some coppers which go onto the zinc. So you have a copper or you don't have a copper, okay, there. And then you get, instead of having one set of lines, you have three sets of lines. It's the same story as the chlorine NMRs that I presented you before. And actually, you can compare, you can do shift measurements. And as you see here, the deuterium NMR has this fast increase at low temperatures, whereas the oxygen 17 NMR has this drop. And the reason why is that you are preferentially coupled through a dipolar coupling to this copper, which are sitting here in deuterium NMR. So that's a bad, I would say, illustration of the fact that you are very site selective. So deuterium is probing preferentially, well, this site, preferentially because the susceptibility is huge, right? Whereas the oxygen is very well coupled to these sites, so something like 100 more times more coupled, and so that you get this. Okay. Now I would like to switch what happens to what happens when there is magnetic ordering. So when you have some magnetic orderings, and you had this line here, and if the hyperfine field is strong enough, so you have an average value of the moment which is non-zero, your nucleus is coupled to this moment. If the field induced on the nucleus is large enough that you can detect a resonance, you will be able to detect a resonance. This is called zero field NMR. It's not a true zero field. It's zero applied field NMR, but you have an internal field. So you can do that. That's one technique. Now you can have some antiferromagnet, and if you are above TC, you have nothing in zero field, and below TC, you have this one. Now if you apply a field, an external field, then it will depend on what you are going to have. If you have an antiferromagnet and you apply a field like this and you are in a single crystal, then you will see an additional field like this or a field which goes the other way. So you expect two lines. So if you are above TC, you have one line. And when you go below TC, what you will get is if you have a ferromagnet, you will get everything the same. And if you have an antiferromagnet, you will get a splitting of the lines. So with this, you can, when you have a spectrum, you can step back. If you have a single crystal, you can find the orientation of the moments, for instance, depending on the way you orient it. Okay. Now, if you have a powder, so if you have a powder, you will have a distribution of angles again, and the line shape is going to depend on which kind of order you have. If you have an antiferromagnet, it's quite easy to show that you will get a rectangular shape. The reason why is that you have your applied field here and you are rotating the field randomly because of your powder average. It's a very easy calculation. It gives you a rectangular shape. Then this is for the case of a spin density wave and or for a Gaussian distribution of the fields. And this is one example. I think this is in Voldborgsite, taken from Takegawa's group. And where you see that by varying the field, you change the line shapes. That tells you that the structure, the magnetic structure, is changing with the field. This is one example of gyrosite, which orders antiferromagnetically. So you have a beautiful proton line above the nail temperature. And below the temperature, you have this square line that I mentioned to you. And this is twice the internal field. And if you know the coupling, which we know from the analysis of the paramagnetic phase, we can deduce the value of the moment, for instance. This is a much more complicated spectrum. My Grenoble colleagues say this is the most expensive NMR spectrum ever measured. That was measured in around 28 Teslas. So this is strontium copper borate, which it's an orthogonal dimer compound. So remember dimer. So if you apply a field, you can break the dimer state, the singlet state, you can bring it to the triplet state under a field. And what happens is that then you have magnetization plateaus and so on. And when you go from below the threshold to above the threshold, you see that your copper spectrum, which should have six lines, actually, because you have two isotopes and three lines per isotope, this is below the singlet triplet crossing, and this is above. And the field of this experiment, which is around 28 Teslas, you cannot access it by neutrons. That would be a dream to have this structure, know the structure using neutrons, but 28 Teslas is still too high for neutrons, I think. And this is just the superstructure, this set of lines is due to the superstructure that you induce when you are on the magnetization plateau there on the triplet state. Okay, so that has been a long story. Just one example of zero field NMR. This is oxygen 17 in spin ice, okay? And that's from Takigawa's group as well. And so if you have this two in, two out spin rule, You can calculate the field. You have a field on the oxygen site, and you can detect a zero field NMR resonance, which is the blue line here. And actually, if you would excite these tetrahedra, so this is a monopole physics, then you should get another line, and you can calculate from the distribution of fields. It should be 25% smaller, as internal field should be 25% smaller. This is Takikawa's work, which has been published in a theory paper. I don't know what is the current status, whether one is able to detect the other site. I think not. And you can say either because you have dynamics or not, or maybe, I don't know whether Masashi tried or not, because this is a low temperature experiment. As well, when you do NQR, you see here you have some ordering, and at low temperatures you see a huge broadening because of the internal fields. So you can track magnetic order in various ways. Zero field NMR, applied field NMR, NQR, and all this you see. Okay. This is a last example for this. This is a J1, J2 model in vanadates. So this is a square. This is a frustration by the geometry of interactions. So you have interactions along the edges and along the diagonals, and you can probe that with lithium. And under the transition, you see the splitting of the lines here that you can trace back like an order parameter. And just to show you the sensitivity of NMR, silicon is in a different site, less symmetric. It's a spin 1/2. And you see that above the transition is at 2.8K, you see a second site appearing here, and which tells you that you have a change in the coupling. The spins do not change. There's a change in the coupling, which means that hyperfine tensor is changing because the structure is changing. So you have structural distortions before the transition. So the question is the transition due to the structural distortions, which really frustration? Okay. I think I'm running out of time. So just in a few words, you can also probe, that's a very very interesting point. You can probe spin textures induced by defects. If you put a defect in your system, you are going to have some inhomogeneity in the susceptibility. And depending how far you are from the defect, the response, there is a staggered response, usually in antiferromagnets, the staggered response is going to be more or less large. So sometimes you can even detect some special lines here. And so this is a maximum effect, and this is due to, this is for the nuclei, which are nearby the defects. And this is one good example in a spin chain. So if you have, this is a Haldane chain, the ground state is singlet. And if you add some zinc, then you are going to break the chain and get a staggered response along the chains. And the way it works, it's very interesting. So you see you have many lines. What you are working on is yttrium, and you are probing the susceptibility along the chains. And when you have one line, and then you see many satellite lines appear. And the way it works is this. So you take your line, you put a local field on the y-axis, and that tells you you have this field, this field, this field, this field. And then this is giving you the amplitude of the oscillation of the staggered response here. So from this, you can extract some correlation lengths around the defect and many other things. So we could use that also in frustrated magnets, put a defect and try to see what it's going to be. This has been used in high ITCs, so this is a map. And the rule is, if you want to see something, for instance, you have one specific line and its satellite due to the defects, then if you add more defects, then the lines are going to broaden because you have the nearby response, but then the further nuclei is going to give you a distribution of susceptibility. And then at the end, you start to get something which you cannot resolve. And if you have too many defects, everything goes to the line width, and the line width is going to increase the susceptibility of the defects. So the track would be have a fraction of percent of defects so that you can resolve the lines. But right now in highly frustrated magnets, at least spin liquids, which are my center of interest, we never succeeded to reach the fraction of percent except in gold bauxite. Otherwise, we always get a line groaning, which is due to the susceptibility of the defects. Okay, so let me go a little bit to the dynamical studies, and then I will wrap up this presentation. So what we do, we apply a field, we have our nuclear magnetization, and we flip it by using, so this is a semi-classical picture, by applying a pulse, an RF pulse. This corresponds to the equilibrium of population, of quantum populations. And then once we have finished the pulse, then you have the magnetization, which is in the plane perpendicular to H0, so it's going to precess. It precesses and loses magnetization in the plane because you have a distribution of fields or you have fluctuating fields along this direction. So this is called T2, relaxation, transverse relaxation. And the other thing that you can do, you restart the experiment, then you have your relaxation, your T2 relaxation. And also, you have come back to the equilibrium where you are going to have the nuclear magnetization coming back to equilibrium. So you have flipped the magnetization, right?
It was there.
And then it turns back to equilibrium
to the Z direction.
And this time is called T1. This is a relaxation, return to equilibrium. Okay. So you have equations of motions of this of the magnetization and these two
relaxation times.
So T1. So as I told you, if you want to treat it using quantum mechanics, so when you do your NMR experiment, you equilibrate the population of these two levels. And then you have to return to the thermal equilibrium. This is T1. So you have a probability, transition probability, that you can calculate using the Fermi-Golden rule. And actually, it's not a very complicated calculation. 1 over T1 is, you have these correlation functions here, local correlation functions between field-field correlation functions, which relates to the spin-spin correlation functions, the time correlation functions. And it's a Fourier transform at the nuclear frequency. So what you are probing is the dynamics at the nuclear frequency, which is very small energy scale as compared to the neutron scale, which is milli electron volts also. We are rather in the micro electron volt energy scale. So you can work out the real 1 over T1 expression. So if you have you are coupled to several sites, you have to sum over all these sites. And you have a sum over Q here. This is what I was telling you in the beginning. You integrate over Q and you have this, this response here. And this relates to the imaginary susceptibility that Colin showed you. We integrate the imaginary susceptibility at all wave vectors and at the frequency. And this is the expression here. Okay. We can have, if we are coupled to several sites, we can have filtering factors, meaning that there are some sites where you won't see, you won't pick up some fluctuations and some others where you can pick them up. And that's kind of Q resolution, our Q resolution, but it's not as extended as with neutrons, of course. And this is famous in high TCs, where if you look at oxygen, if you have antiferromagnetic fluctuations, for instance, they will be filtered out. Because antiferromagnetic fluctuations, you have this, you have these fluctuations, right? And the field at the oxygen site is always going to be zero on these fluctuations. So you won't see anything. And On the coupler, on the contrary, coupler, you have an on-site coupling plus coupling to the others, and you will pick up the fluctuations on the site here, schematically speaking. And actually, what you see here, oxygen doesn't see the magnetic fluctuations, the anti-ferromagnetic fluctuations, whereas here you have a huge peak here, like this. Okay. Then you have a spectrum of fluctuations. And if you have simple correlation functions with a single frequency dynamics, then you can write this very simply as a Fourier transform of the exponential Isler-Lorentzian. And if you are in the motional narrowing limit, which is when the frequency of the NMR is much smaller than the frequency of fluctuation, so imagine a paramagnet, it fluctuates, the correlation times is of the order of 10 to minus 14 seconds or minus 12 seconds. So the frequency is very high as compared to the nuclear frequency. Then you can neglect this, and then you have 1 over T1, which is simply this expression, which is a measure of the correlation time, and which is temperature independent in the paramagnetic phase. And in the paramagnetic phase, what makes your spins fluctuate is simply the coupling between the spins. So actually, 1 over T1, you can calculate the frequency of the correlations, which is just J divided by H bar. And 1 over T1 is going to be this high temperature limit, which is temperature independent. Okay, you can. So when you have a transition, I'm nearly finished. When you have a transition, what happens? So you are going to slow, when you come from the high temperature, you are going to have a slowing down of the spin fluctuations down to the static limit. And when you are sitting here in frequency at nearby zero with your nuclei, so this is a high temperature, you have a large correlation, large spectral function, and then it's going to narrow when you go through the transition to get to be centered around zero when you are steady. So this is this T1 here. Then you have your distribution which narrows, then it goes to the peak here, and then it's even narrower and you have nothing left at, less left at omega n here, and then you go down and you have nothing left here. Okay, so you have a peak in relaxation because you see the slowing down of fluctuations. It goes through omega n and then goes even below. So you have a peak, usually, when you have a slowing down of fluctuations, the critical regime, you have the critical regime, and then you don't see anything anymore. And this can be observed like in these vanadates, the high temperature limit, the paramagnetic limit, the peak here because there is a transition and something here. And when you have a gap, you will get gapped excitations. So 1 over T1, which has a huge gap here, this is in the semi-log scale. You can plot this and you can extract a gap. And in most spin liquids, you don't have a gap. So that's another way to track the gap in spin liquids. Look at T1, and this is a power law that you have here. This is for Herbert's missile. Okay, this is how to extract the gap from our Arrhenius plot. And okay, we can also use these difference of relaxation times, because the relaxation times depend on the site, to resolve some sites on the spectra. We call that contrast experiments. Usually we use a T2 there, and we vary the time as compared to T2, and we can get different shape of spectra, which allows us to resolve some sites. So this is one spectrum on Waldorf site, and then this is two sites that you can distinguish because they have different relaxation times. It's exactly the same as in MRI, actually. So okay. Sometimes relaxation kills your signal, and in NMR, okay, so in NMR you lose your signal because of the relaxation processes, and in USR you see the slowing down here, and if you had a real transition, then you would get something which goes down, and you have a plateau here, and that's a limit of NMR. Sometimes you have a wipeout of the signal because you have persistent fluctuations. And you cannot recover the signal. It's fluctuating too fast on your time scale. OK. So I had no time to compare to mu sr, sorry. So with this, I would like to conclude. So I've shown you that we can probe static and dynamic properties. We have specially resolved static susceptibility. We can see inhomogeneities, distribution of local field, charge effects, ordered spaces, spin textures. Various techniques, applied field, electric field gradients, polypolar effects, zero applied field, MQR, zero field NMR. Work on single crystals is great when you have single crystals. And with measuring the relaxation times, you access the nature of the excitations. You can also map out correlations that I have no time to enter into the details and follow what happens in critical regions. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much, Philip. So we have time for a couple of questions from people, if they're not too tired. So, yes, please, Lucille.
Can you
What is the resolution for measuring the gap? What is the lower limit, you would say, right? I would say typically we can measure very small gaps like this. If you have any gap, right? We are working at a nuclear frequency, which is micro electron volts, right? And so, what is going to limit your sensitivity to the gap is the temperature range on which you can access. Right? If you have a gap which is very small, which is like 100 mK, you have to measure below that temperature, right? So I would say the limit is more going to be the temperature range we can access than typically from the technique. Okay.
Any further questions? Well, if not, I'd like to thank Philip for his talk and